time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Reverend Rich Lang and Reverend John Helmier. Reverend Rich Lang is pastor at University Temple United Methodist Church here in Seattle, and Reverend John Helmier is founder of the Valley and Mountain Fellowship Church here also in Seattle up on Beacon Hill. Rich and John, thank you both for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with you, John. Well, let's start with you both. Could you briefly tell us about your two churches?
I'm pastor of a United Methodist Church. It's in the U District. And, in distinction from John, it's more of a traditional church, been around for 100 years. And actually had a part to play in the building of Husky Stadium. So, we're really entrenched. We're a longtime city church here.
And I'm the minister at Valley and Mountain, which is in Columbia City in the Rainier Valley. We're only about a year old. We meet in a school gym. It's a multi-generational, multi-ethnic, alternative church community.
All right. So you have both been involved with the Occupy Seattle movement, and both have had fairly dramatic experiences during protests. During your work there. And I want to start with you first, John. You had you actually got some major media attention this last week. There was a protest tied to Occupy Seattle that was held at the ports at a couple of the terminals there on Monday. Can you tell us how you came to be at that protest and what happened?
Sure. Well, I went down to the port protest for two main reasons. One is to bring attention to the plight of the port truck drivers, the drayage drivers who take the containers in and out of the port, who are some of the most exploited and underpaid laborers in our city. There's been a campaign to discredit that claim recently, saying they make almost $30,000, which is true, but that's wages out of which, since they're independent contractors, they have to pay for their trucks, their upkeep, the gas, and all the expenses associated with that. So their take-home pay is abysmal. They call themselves serfs on wheels. They're not allowed to use the bathrooms inside the port, the employee bathrooms. So many of them carry empty water bottles and plastic bags in their car to do their human needs. And they just say they're treated like dogs. So I went down there to bring attention to that. And also because on a broader level, I think there's a system failure in our country. And the Occupy movement is exposing that. I think the system in our country, the economic and political systems, are benefiting the very few at the expense of the very many. And power and money and wealth and voice are being consolidated. So I went down there for that reason as well.
All right. So what happened Monday night?
Sometime 4:30 or 5, I went over to Pier 18. I'd been peacefully picketing with a small group of about 40, a side entrance. We were letting people in and out, but trying to make a statement. Then I went over to Pier 18, which was a much larger group. There were over 100 people in the road blocking an entrance to the port. And as I approached, I could sense that there was a lot of tension in the air. There was a great number of police there, a lot of bicycle police. Soon mounted police showed up, and they seemed to be organizing to do something. And it was getting dark, and I started worrying that as darkness fell, something was going to break out, and they were gathering to advance on the crowd. And quite frankly, I was scared. I wasn't sure what was going to happen, and I thought about leaving. I'm just telling you what was going on inside me, but I kind of felt like I'd done my duty. I'd been there 4 hours, and it was freezing cold, and we were actually supposed to host a holiday cookie exchange party for our block of neighbors at home, and I wanted to get home for that. But I serve as a chaplain in the movement, and a chaplain, whether you're in the prison, the military, Congress, or a hospital, you commit to being present in situations of doubt and fear. And so I felt that commitment come through, and I decided to walk into the crowd and be in the mix of everything. And then as soon as it got dark, the police formed a line and started moving in quickly on the group in the road. And so I came up to the front, to the area in between briefly and was shouting, keep the peace, keep the peace. Suddenly the police got very close and, I was on the front line and linked arms with someone on my right and left, to show, not aggression, but simply, defense and that we were nonviolent because with arms tied, with arms linked, we couldn't hurt anybody. Unless we were doing some kind of Irish step dance, you know, kick line kind of thing, which we were not coordinated enough to do. So they were advancing on us, these menacing expressions on their faces. There's right in front of me, there was a line of bicycle police. They were thrusting their bicycles into us and reaching across, shoving violently. I was yelling, keep the peace, keep the peace. I actually talked to a Seattle Times reporter recently who said he could hear me yelling that. Above the crowd, keep the peace, do not respond with violence. I was also addressing some of the police in front of me. I was trying to be a peacemaker in this situation. And one of the police officers, I look him in the eye and say, why are you causing violence to peaceful people? Think about what you're doing. And shortly thereafter, with an open hand, he rammed me in the throat. And he was being very, very, very violent. There was an old man nearby who after getting pushed violently reared back to throw a punch, and I stopped him from doing that, trying to be, you know, not just this on one side or the other, but a peacemaker for everyone in that situation. And shortly thereafter I get pulled down from behind, and there's a lot of video footage of this that's come out. I'm standing there with linked arms and an officer comes up and rips me down from the back of my coat. And I land on the ground and somebody gets on top of me. The right side of my face is pressed against the asphalt. And my hands are immobilized and, he starts punching me in the face full on with my, you know, with my head against the asphalt. And I'm hearing crunching sounds and it's excruciatingly painful. I had enough time while he was doing this to pray that I wasn't going to get brain damage. I was so terrified and scared and screaming and shouting, I'm a man of peace and I'm not resisting. And finally it stopped. And someone cuffed me and pulled me up. And the guy who pulled me up, pretty sure is not the same one because he actually did it very gently. And seemed pretty appalled by, what he saw because I was wearing my clerical collar. And my face was beaten up at this point. And he said something like, who are you? What are you doing here? And I said, I'm a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I believe another world is possible. He asked me if I could walk, and I was able to kind of shuffle my way over to the van. Right before I did that, too, an officer, this is a nice thing, picked up my phone off the ground. It had fallen out of my jacket and came and was like, is this your phone? And I said, yes, and he put it in my pocket. So I'm not here to say all the police in the world are, you know, evil cretins. I was treated by these two guys nicely enough, but certainly there was a lot of rough treatment as well. So we get into the van. First, it's just me by myself, and I was in the police van for a while in this little cage, terrified, didn't know what was happening, didn't know where they'd take me. I was singing This Little Light of Mine to kind of ward off my fears and anxieties, and eventually they take us to a holding cell, where our hands were cuffed this whole time. We get to a holding cell. It's a room somewhere with no anything in it, no benches, no bathroom facilities. And left in this room for a couple hours, me and this young man. Eventually they take us to the King County Jail, where I was for, I would guess, 8 hours. Moved from cell to cell. They put us into prison clothes, and put us in probably 4 or 5 different cells over the course of the next 8 hours, with the general jail population. In these cells, here's one of the crazy things. They're blowing cold air into the cells, and everybody's freezing because you got these just thin jailed cotton short-sleeved shirts on, this kind of thing. And sandals, and everybody's got their arms inside their shirt, hugging their bodies, kind of rotating back and forth. I asked for medical attention a number of times because of my wound. I was worried that I never saw myself, but I could feel the blood on my head, and people were saying, wow, what happened to you? I was asking for some kind of medical attention, and the wounds on my face made it hard for me to lie down. After 8 hours, it's almost 5 in the morning. I'm exhausted. Everybody else is lying down on the ground on the benches, and I can't because blood starts pounding in my face when I do that. And they keep saying, "Oh, we'll have you see a nurse eventually." In my 11th hour of incarceration, I flag down a nurse who takes pity on me because I look so pathetic. She comes over and asks what I need, and I explain, and she gives me a pack of ice.
You know, this one of the things that strikes me in John's story, both here and reading it, is one of the things that Occupy is doing that sometimes I think folks don't understand because they keep saying, "What's their agenda? What do they want?" Nah, nah, nah. Right now, the Occupy movement is, in my opinion, a kind of a deconstruction movement. What it's attempting to do is simply pull the curtain back and saying, look, we have massive systems failures. It's not just a few bad apples here and there. It's kind of like your description of the police. You know, even on that police line, you had some police that are brutalizers, and you had some police that maintain their humanity and fulfilled their function, their rightful function of policing. And in our systems, across the board, we have these massive, massive system failures that not only are demoralizing our country, but gutting democracy. And when I hear you talk about what happens to you inside the jail, I realize again, you know, it's another systems failure. It's how many steps from how you're treated, how many more steps do we go down into that basement that eventually leads to the public itself being seen as enemy combatants?
Right.
'Cause no matter what happened to you, here you get brought in by the police to the prison system. Mm-hmm. You haven't had your day in court. You know, nobody knows if you're guilty or innocent, but you're treated brutally inside the system. Now, the poor and people of color, they know this. They've known this for years and years and years. And I think one of the things that the Occupy movement is deconstructing for white middle class people like myself, mm-hmm. is it's pulling back the curtain and say, you know, this used to happen as a matter of course, and the Department of Justice has kind of been, just in the last few days, is detailing this for us in Seattle. This was a matter of course of how people were treated when they were poor or when they were a minority. Now it's beginning to happen to the middle class, and it's beginning to happen to white folk. And it's once again, I think, showing what the temperature of our country is. Once we started down the road of injustice, it just keeps spiraling further and further and further towards chaos and atrophy. So your story is I just think a revealing of so many of our systems failures in this country.
Yesterday, I believe SPD had a press conference where, according to the paper, that Seattle Police Mike Sanford spoke and said they had video footage of protesters throwing a flare and bricks and bags of paint at officers. Did you see that, and or was that also supposedly taking place at the specific spot you were at there, John?
I didn't see any of that. My wife was there. She was on the sidelines, pretty far away, near where a lot of the police were, but farther away, kind of watching, and she was trying to take some video. It didn't work. Our camera is scrappy. But she was back there. She said she saw the flare thrown and actually landed near her. She said it was, like, lobbed way over everybody's head. It was not really aggressive, dangerous. I didn't see anything personally being thrown. Doesn't mean it didn't happen.
You know, one of the, the press, again, another systems failure, another revelation of the Occupy movement is just how incredibly inept and or corrupt the media have become.
Right.
And so the spin that goes out there is these crazy protesters attacking the horses and the police. you know, I've been on a lot of protests in my, you know, I've been in Seattle now for 12 years and I've been on a lot of protests and, this is just anecdotal, but every time I have been around provocations, I mean, you obviously have people who are riled up, in the protest march itself. But certainly in the Occupy movement and even before in the anti-war movement, the crowd kind of polices its own. You know, we don't want, you know, windows busted out. We don't want anarchy. We don't want rampaging in the streets. And the crowd attempts to police its own. In every case where I've seen provocation, the police themselves are doing the are provoking, if not aggressively, they're provoking back and forth, which is, once again, a systems failure. It goes to the competency of those line commanders to keep their charges, you know, in line. And so an example of this is, you know, when I was pepper sprayed, and this was the day of the night that Dorley Ramey was pepper sprayed, which I think was a police riot. You know, when you see the video of that, I mean, they're just dumping gallons of pepper spray indiscriminately on a
whole
crowd.
This is a month prior, November 15th.
Yeah, November 15th. But and earlier that day, I'm in Belltown, and I'm marching along with the protesters. What struck me is how rapidly, how quickly the police dumped their bikes, and so much of this is the bike patrol, which I think are really a lot of cowboys. They dump their bikes, they start spraying indiscriminately, and so the crowd bolts away. Makes sense to me. I'd bolt away too. There is a separation made. The police, in their discipline, hold their line, so they didn't go charging after anybody. The Occupy movement ran up against a wall. There's a clear separation, incident over. And at that point, but you know, there's mist, you know, there's pepper spray in the air and there's chaos and yelling and so forth. In the midst of that, I stepped in between. So I'm kind of in this no man's land. Nobody is around me and I'm in full vestments and I'm being soaked down by the police from behind me. And then one officer steps up and hits me in the face with the spray, squirts me in the face. This is a systems failure. You know, at that point, you know, I'm certainly not a threat, and everybody, you know, I've been on the protest the whole way. Everybody there, it's not a huge protest. Everybody there, the entire bike line understands my role. The march itself understands my role. And so this was a belligerent assault, using the symbol of which I am, a symbol of leadership and legitimacy. And, this kind of breakdown, of a system, this kind of breakdown in morality of policing is I think a huge issue that we need to pay attention to, in particular now that the Department of Justice has legitimated it as an issue. Our police department is becoming more and more incompetent. Where I go with these things, and what I get worried about is, you know, John and I are kind of in the business of trying to grasp and understand human nature. And with the meanness that is happening to our American character across the board, our inability to talk with each other about political issues and economic issues, the division between, you know, blue and red states and so forth, and the outrages that we've seen across the land of how the police have been aggressively brutalizing a nonviolent movement, I just keep coming back to, you know, where does this stop? And although these are provocative statements, I would hope that people and the police department would pause and think about them. You know, the police in Germany are no different than the police in America, but something happened in their evolution to turn good German policing into German SS troops and German Nazi troops. Turning citizens against citizens on behalf of something evil and something wicked. In El Salvador, you know, legitimate policing, you descended into death squads. Where's the stop for our own police. When they want to brutalize us in public and are not held to account, and when we're put into a system that year by year is becoming more and more dehumanizing, as John was articulating, at what point, where does it stop? And anyone who has worked with the Department of Corrections, or attempted to work with the Department of Corrections, anyone who has attempted to try to get a grasp on citizen control of what's happening in our prisons, comes up against multiple brick walls. It's just this hidden story in our American political scene, and I'm very worried about it, because I'm seeing a harshness coming down from on high, from our political structure on high, which includes just this last week, the Senate and the House, and the president's going to sign a bill that simply violates and takes away our Bill of Rights, where the military can detain us indefinitely in this ongoing war of terror. At what point does the American citizens start scratching their head and saying, what happened to our country?
If you can wade through the comments sections in our local newspapers, one of the more reasonable responses to the ills that you just listed out there, Rich, is, well, we have checks and balances in the system, and the people that are occupying aren't, you know, going through the legitimate system that we've set up. Quick question about, since your incident was a month ago, did you attempt to go through channels to have that addressed?
I have a, you know, complaint that if I ever hear back from, I'll be very surprised. I have absolutely no confidence in the system to address the assault on my character. And I say that as a privileged, solidly middle-class white male. I mean, I'm what the system is built for. And I'm clergy, which is a symbolic function. And that system's not even working for me. And I'm more up on the top of the food line, not the bottom of the food line. And so what is that saying about our country?
Yeah, Rich and I are just exposing things that, as he mentioned, have been experienced for as long as this country's been in existence by people of color and poor folks. People keep asking me, what needs to change in the police force? As though I have some, you know, great insight into it. You know, I can say, well, they shouldn't have beat me up for no reason. But in terms of policy change, what you need to do is go talk to Mothers for Police Accountability, who's been doing this for 22 years in organizing the African-American community. They have a lot of really good ideas. The United Black Clergy did a press conference yesterday. There was only one camera there because people, you know, not getting the attention they deserve. While my story goes viral because of my social status, it's a terrible injustice, and I just want to kind of keep that at the forefront too. That I'm aware and acknowledge that my story is so big because of the injustice in the system, but that doesn't mean I'm going to stop telling it. It means I need to tell it and point people when they're asking me these things to those groups who've been working on this for a much longer time.
You know, I'd like to. I know we got just a few minutes here. I wanted to. Throw something out about the Occupy movement that impressed me, and it's from a spiritual point of view. And since John and I are both clergy, you know, we do. I think both of us look at this sometimes a little differently than the public. And I kept going up every time I'd go up to the encampment before they broke apart. Every time I'd go up there, I'd take a look around and I'd say, my gosh, what good can come out of this? I mean, it was just, you know, it's like, you know, it just looked like mass chaos to me. But every time I'd go up there and I would talk with the residents that were living in the camps, I'd come back strengthened and encouraged. And one of the things I found up there that that warmed my heart and opened my mind is they were an encampment that really, truly, honestly wanted to include everybody. And so there were the real focused, zealous, serious folks that were there for Occupy reasons, that they were making a political statement, that they wanted their country back, they wanted their young people, they wanted a future. and they felt that they have no representation, and this is, you know, they're putting their bodies on the line, and they certainly were, and sleeping out in all kinds of miserable weather. But then you had the drug addict people, and then you had the moochers, and then you kind of had the toughs that just like to cause disruption. But the movement never wanted to get rid of them. They never wanted to, even though that was, in a sense, baggage that held them down, and they had to keep dealing with this, you know, how do we live together? They were always focused on, there's no going into the future if we're going to just throw away people, which is, and the analogy I want to make is the early church. Rodney Stark, who used to teach here at the UW, wrote a wonderful book, I think it's called The Birth of Christianity, where he did a study and he asked the question, why did the church explode in growth in the early hundreds? This is before Constantine. Why it exploded in growth was there was a series of years that lasted over a decade of great famines continued through, Italy and Greece and Turkey, and this is where the church was getting started, and it was just a minority movement. People of means could get out of the cities, and the Christians who weren't of means, they stayed in the cities. And what they did there is they cared for people. They housed people. They saved babies from dying. They gave food away. They shared their possessions with each other and with others, and that's where the phrase came from, my, how they love one another. And that movement began to attract people because of the solidarity that they had with each other as Christians, a minority religion at the time, but also their expansiveness, their openness to others. And I look at this young, very young group of people leading the Occupy movement, and I see the same kind of spirituality at work in those tents and in that movement. And I just wanted to lift that up, is that something more than politics is happening, and it is our young people that are leading it.
It puts this church to shame, how much more caring and loving they are. And I really hope that this kind of thing inspires others in our profession and doing what we do, and the members of churches and religious communities everywhere. There's a quote by Elizabeth Cady Stanton that's been resonating with me recently. She's a woman suffragist, and I believe she was a Quaker. And she said, the moment that we begin, that we don't tell the truth that is within us because of fear of public opinion, the divine floods of light and life stop flowing into our souls. And there's a spiritual crisis that goes on when you don't tell the truth, when you are afraid. Out there, when I was on the verge of running away because the mounted police were terrifying and the bike police were menacing, I had a choice between running away, which is what I wanted to do, and staying out there. And the only reason I stayed out there is because I've heard so many stories like Rich of people who stayed when they could have gone. And I consider myself a pretty cowardly person, to be honest, but I got courage from others. And I hope that our stories can offer some folks out there enough inspiration to take their own stands, because we're just two small examples, and there's hundreds of these things happening right now, but we need more.
Talking with Reverend Rich Lang and Reverend John Helmier, how can people find out more about your two churches, organizations?
Our website is valleyandmountain.org. That's the best way to find us.
And we're right in the U District in a big, massive, massive building. You can't miss it, right across from the University Bookstore, and it's utemple.org.
We're kind of like a Wiley network like Occupy. You can't really pin us down.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us on.